big up all the teachers. Time to teach a new way. Maybe then they'll listen to what you have to say. They're the ones who's coming up, and the world is in their hands. When you teach the children to jump the very best.
Good morning. Thank you for joining us today on Wake Up. My name is Larry Ivory. I am the host of Wake Up Today, the president CEO of the Illinois State Black Chamber of Commerce. This moment that we get a chance to share with you is designed to wake us up. We have a lot of different challenges in front of us. We have an exciting group of panelists who are experts in the area of procurement and things that impact us economically. And we have often had a conversation on voter suppression. We're going to talk about procurement suppression. We have some special guests. Let me introduce a couple of our very special guests who are expert in their field of procurement. First, we'll start with our special guest here who's sitting across from me. He is the past director of Central Management Service. I'll let him tell you a little bit about himself, and then we'll have Charlotte Roberts, who's the head of diversity for the University of Illinois, and none other than the exceptional person that everyone knows when it comes to media is Carl West. So I'm going to have each of them introduce themselves, starting with Mr. Weems.
Good morning, Larry. My name is Malcolm Weems. I formerly spent about 15 years in working in government, so centered a lot around budget and procurement. My last role was as director of Central Management Services for the state of Illinois. I've since became a consultant and sometimes lobbyist, pushing minority business issues. Good to be here.
Thank you, Malcolm. Next, we'll have Charlotte Roberts.
Thank you, Mr. Ivory. Again, my name is Charlotte Roberts. I am the director of procurement diversity at the University of Illinois. In that role, I'm responsible for ensuring minorities, women, and persons with disabilities are able to participate in the University of Illinois' procurement process. I also sit on the Business Enterprise Program Council that governs the state of Illinois' supplier diversity program, and I'm glad to be here to provide my expertise in this area. Thank you again for inviting me, Mr. Ivory.
Thank you, Ms. Roberts. And another, Carl West.
Larry, what's up, man? Good morning to everybody. Larry, Charlotte, and Malcolm, what's going on?
How you feeling?
Good morning. Good morning. I'm ready for this conversation.
Well,
yes,
guys.
Indeed. Yes, indeed. So let me reintroduce myself, because Larry gave a brief overview. But I'm Carl West, the CEO of MG Media, which is the founding managing editor of TBT News. And I got several other digital platforms, but that's the main one that has brought me to the attention of, I guess if you on a digital scale, you can say the world, but you know how that goes. And I'm also the chairman of the board of the Black United Fund of Illinois, which I'm, that particular appointment was something that I dreamed about. So it is such a great thing to be able to have a dream, have dreams, that is, and then have some of those dreams, land in your lap, of course, but nothing lands in your lap without hard work and commitment and dedication. So I'm just fortunate to be in the space that I'm in today. And so a lot of work to do, and I'm sure with these joint individuals here, we will continue to strive to make Black folks more progressive, powerful, and wealthy, and influential in the state and across the globe.
Right on.
Thank you, Mr. West. Hey, we're going to start this conversation off because I think it's important to make a relevant correlation. We talk about voter suppression, which I think most people understand, but I'm going to ask one of the guests, anyone can jump in, and talk about what voter suppression is to you, and then I'm going to ask someone to talk about what they think procurement suppression is in correlation. So anyone, you can jump in. If not, I'll choose someone.
I'm gonna nominate Malcolm.
Thanks. Well, listen, I mean, voter suppression is the practice of trying to make sure folks cannot exercise their right to vote, making impediments for folks, specifically Black folks, stopping us from being able to vote and influence elections and decide who our political leaders are. Again, that's pretty much the gist as I see it.
I would agree with Malcolm, Larry, that voter suppression to me is when the system put barriers in place to ensure a group of people are not able to exercise their right to vote. So I would agree with Malcolm that putting barriers in place from a systematic standpoint, allowing a group of people not having that ability to exercise their right.
Their constitutional right to
That's
vote.
That's right.
Carl, you want to add anything to that?
Outside of that, our community have never known a moment where we was not suppressed in the voting process as well as in the procurement process, as you were going to allude to, get to next. But, you know, I always try to look at, even though voter suppression has been around forever, right? We've always been kind of targeted as that class of people that was restricted from living normal lives, in a sense, and still to this day. But also always got to remember that think about what we've accomplished and done in spite of, right? So you can imagine if we were able to be allowed to play on an even field. I think that's probably what the fear is, right? The reason why they have, because they knew our strength all the way from slavery. They knew we was powerful, strong, and smart people, and so they had to figure out how to slow our pace down. And even through voter suppression, I mean, we still got, what, a Black president? If that means something, we, you know, whatever it means to people that we got Biden today to hopefully substitute what we had prior to him. But again, I always try to think about, what if we didn't have those obstacles faced in front of us? Can we imagine where we would sit? We would sit on the throne, right? We would have thrones. We would just be, I mean, I always think about that, like, wow, what we've done in spite of what has been put in front of us, these obstacles, and we still continue to shine as best as possible. Can you imagine if we didn't have those obstacles, man? It would be an amazing race of people. And I think that's the fear of the Black planet, right?
Right.
Absolutely. Well, let me ask this, because we're spending a little more time on this conversation of voter suppression, even though we think we know our listening audience understands what voter suppression really means. We can clearly see that Georgia, if they had continued what they had done, then Georgia would not have been a blue state, because there was a concentrated effort to suppress Black vote. And most of the Black votes were going to the Democratic Party. Now, one of the things that we say at the chamber is that we are a bipartisan organization. We don't really care whether you're Democrat or Republican. We care about policy. Are the policy good for us or bad for us? But an example that we're trying to get to today is that we clearly see where voter suppression, and because of the energy that people put into it legally, they reduce the consequences of voter suppression. Now we need to talk about what people often don't talk about is procurement suppression. And I'm going to ask each of you again, what does that mean? Because we invited these guests on because they are expert in the subject that we're talking about, procurement, and procurement impacts money and wealth. And there is a significant wealth gap in our country. So I'm going to pass it to Malcolm again to kind of give his perception of, or his words as it relates to voter or procurement suppression. What does that mean?
Oh, thanks, Larry. I think that it's great. It's a good idea. I think Black folks understand voter suppression, and I think it's good that we started talking about something that people can apply the concept to. So when you talk about procurement suppression, you're talking about government procurement opportunities and suppressing, the ability of folks like us, like black folks, minorities, the ability to participate in that economy. So, for example, I always tell people, you know, the state of Illinois, at least when I was there, I believe was the 19th largest economy in the world. So, you know, states in the United States of America are economies to themselves. And so when the state of Illinois institutes a goal in terms of participation on a contract, what they're saying is 20% of their spend. Now, this is, again, a state that spends just in state revenue over $30 billion every year. Every year. And soon it'll be up to 40. I mean, and so this state spends all that money. And if we're saying that a portion of that 20% of the spend should be going to minorities, that's a whole economy. So when you suppress the ability of black businesses to participate in that government procurement economy, then you're talking about a lot of money. You're talking about it could be $1 billion that could go to black communities, that could go to hiring black people, generating black wealth. And we all know that all of our problems, whether they're social, economic, education, or if we're talking about, you know, dealing with law enforcement, all of these problems, really, they evolve around poverty. And so, you know, economics has to drive our community's ascension, right? Or at least in our repair. So when you talk about procurement suppression, you're really talking about they're, you know, creating systematic ways even to get around the laws that were put in place to make sure we participate. And so that, to me, is something that black folks hopefully can relate to when they think about voter suppression. You think about your opportunity to get a contract if you have a black business with a government agency. They're suppressing that, too.
Thank you, Malcolm. And I'm just going to chime in, and I'm going to pass it on to our other two guests. You know, when you go back and take a look at, you know, when we first got the right to vote, they had incredible things that convince us or deny us an opportunity to vote, like counting the number of jelly beans in a jar. And if you couldn't pick the right number, then you couldn't vote. You know, it was ridiculous, and it denied people a chance to participate. Charlotte, give us your perspective when we talk about voter suppression. And then, Carl, right after Charlotte, give us your perspective just from your point of view.
You know what, Larry? I'm glad that we're having this conversation and we're taking a fundamental thing of people understanding voter suppression and using that same concept to educate them on what procurement suppression is. And it's basically where the state has created laws and put laws in place, whether they're from the supplier diversity standpoint or whether they're from the procurement standpoint, to create burdens for eligible people to exercise to be able to participate in the procurement process. Too many times, too often, I hear vendors or black-owned companies say, oh, the certification process is too long. So those are things when you say creating burdens for people to be able to participate, or the arduous process that it takes to bid in the procurement process. So those two things, especially when it deals with minority and women-owned vendors, I hear it all the time. I go out, educate minority and women-owned firms on how to do business with the University of Illinois. And one thing that I hear all the time is the process, the laws that are in place, the certification process to become a certified minority and women-owned firm, the process and the paperwork that is out there to complete in order to put a bid in, the process that's in place to try to find the bids from the four different chief procurement officers that have been established by the state of Illinois. We don't make it easy for vendors to do business with the state of Illinois. So when you talk about voter suppression, it's the things systematic from a systematic standpoint that are put in place to create burdens for vendors to participate. And it's the procurement process that I hear about all the time and the certification process.
Thank you, Charlotte. Mr. West,
Yes. Here's what I want to do. I want to yield my time to Charlotte because she's the expert, right? I want Charlotte to define to our listeners exactly what procurement is. What does that mean?
So basically what procurement is if at the state of Illinois, as Malcolm stated earlier, the state spends roughly $50 billion just within the state, not including all the other entities in the universities. But we'll just look at, analyze the state. So if the state spends $50 billion on its on things that it purchased. So procurement is a fancy word for what the state of Illinois buys. So the state of Illinois buys everything for a university to operate, hospitals to operate, Department of Human Service to operate, as well as central management service and the buildings they maintain. So all of those departments have budgets that the legislature approve annually. And then they have those budgets to go out and spend to satisfy the mission of that particular agency. So when you talk about procurable spend, when you get a budget, half of that budget goes to salary and the rest of that budget goes to the operation, meaning the things that they need to operate. Whether it's the Department of Correction, having food for the inmates or beds for the inmates, they have a thing called procurable spend. And everything that's over $100,000 by law and is stated in law has to go out for bid. There's a formal bidding process, whether it's done through an invitation for bid process or whether it's done through an RFP process. But essentially, the state of Illinois puts out bids on their procurement bulletin. Minority women or any firm has to register on that bulletin so they can learn about those bids. And once they learn about those bids, they have an opportunity to bid as prime vendors, or if there's a goal on that particular contract, a minority and women business goal on that contract, they can participate as subcontractors. So the procurement process is a vehicle where state agencies are allowed to procure things to support their business needs.
And in a nutshell, ladies and gentlemen, what we're saying, I think we can agree upon this, that when we take a look at that whole procurement process, that when we take a look at the number of black businesses that participate in the procurement opportunity and winning contracts, the numbers are not overly exciting. Just like you would say voter suppression, they suppressed 20% of the vote, which gave someone else the election. We can say that there's a significant degree of suppression when it comes to rules and regulations that make it difficult for us to participate. One of the things I want to kind of get into, and we're going to give some real examples, because we want our audience to really walk away with a much better understanding of why procurement is so important and how it creates wealth and how it transforms our community and it actually saves the lives of young black men and women in the street. Because when we don't have companies and businesses growing and they don't see role models who are successful business people and they're not going to the schools and they're not engaging and taking the kids to the NBA basketball game because there's no money, no resources, then you're going to have a kid who's looking for someone else as a model. And sometimes that model is not a very positive person, but that's all they see. And so when we don't get that opportunity, I think it perpetuates what America doesn't need. And I think it's incumbent upon us to talk about these issues in a way that's slightly different, that's far more transparent and make sure that the people who are listening to us today really walk away with kind of a mission and objective. So let's talk about specific things. Let me give you one other quick example to the team. You know, recently they passed a gas tax.
Mm-hmm.
The gas tax was for a capital budget, which was about $45 billion capital budget. And in order to pass a capital budget, they had to have the gas tax funded, which means that every time you would go to the pump, you paid for infrastructure or the capital budget. Mm-hmm. But when we take a look at how many contracts we get in reference to our contribution, then it's out of line. So we don't nearly get what we contribute. And we always say that you have a right to participate where your dollars help create the opportunity. And can any of you give examples, you know, specific examples? Because, you know, I also serve on the BEP Council in the Procurement Policy Board. And Charlotte and I, and I know Malcolm was at our BEP Council meeting. It's a public meeting, and it's where we have to fight and advocate for black business to get a fair opportunity. And there's a lot of games that people play. So we're going to talk a little about some specific things, but I want, if anyone want to share any specific examples outside of what we're going to really talk about, what we think is a fundamental problem in procurement.
If I could, you know, and now, you know, Larry, my, you know, once being a guy on the inside trying to fight for these things, and now being running my own business and trying to fight for these things, you know, I think before I give the examples, the question has to always be, just like when you said in voter suppression, we know what the why was. They didn't want us to vote. We didn't want us to impact elections and didn't want us picking leaders. That means we get stuff, you know, from government. So the question here has to be, why? You know, we're talking about this procurement suppression is, why are they suppressing it, right? We're talking about a state of Illinois, for example, where it's a Democratic House, Democratic Democrats have the House, the Senate, and the governor's mansion. So these are Democrats all care about black folks, right? Why are we negotiating against our allies to, you know, enforce this part of the law that would bring dollars into our communities? Why is that a discussion, right? If we all on the same team, that should be something that should happen almost automatically. So the real issue I see starts to be, well, maybe we're not all on the same side in with regard to what black folks and black business need, right? And so the examples that, you know, that I want us to talk about today are going to be examples of, the state has an opportunity to put out a, let's just say, $100 million contract. And this is a real example, but, you know, put out a $100 million contract. The law says the state is supposed to try to put 20% of that spend, of that $100 million contract, should be going to a minority or woman-owned business. Right? That's what the state, that's what the law says. Instead, what happens is somebody within these agencies makes the decision to say, hey, we're not going to do 20% because that would just be too hard for the vendor. We're going to do 1%. So what that means is, instead of $20 million possibly going to our community, $1 million will go, and so on and so forth. So if we're only getting 1/20th of what the law is telling us we're supposed to, we're not going to see equity and parity and all of those things that matter for our businesses to grow. So I go back to why. And I believe that when we think about racism, we think of somebody screaming and spitting and calling us a name. But when I think about racism, I think about people blocking me from getting to the money.
That's real racism.
that's the real racism. And so that's what I think we have to really think about. A lot of the folks that we are allied with that say they want the same things, you know, the example of, you know, there are a lot of people angry. And again, you know, I know there's a sister that's really working hard in government, Toy Hutchinson, but there are people upset with marijuana, right? And this is because they feel like there's a block for them to get to participating. But the real thing is that the rules, and even the rules around the law that already exists, there are people that are adding subjective thought to how those things are supposed to be carried out, and they're creating that suppression that we're talking about. So my example is, if there's a $100 million contract, $20 million should be going to diverse businesses in some form or fashion. And if it's only $1 million, well, there you are. There's our first loss of $19 million to our community. That should be enough for me to go to my ally and say, what's happening? We should fix this.
Absolutely.
Larry, I would agree with Malcolm. I could go down the list and give you tons of examples, because I've done this and sat on the council and worked inside government for a number of years. And what I see is, you can call out the Department of Corrections. They very rarely even follow the procurement. And Larry, you like to give this example in our council meetings. They don't like to put goals on their contracts. And when minority and females break the law, we go to jail. when the Department of Correction break the law, when Malcolm said the law says not less than 20% should be done with minority women-owned vendors, nothing happens to them.
Right.
Yep.
So there are laws in place that said we shall do business with the minority women-owned vendors and not less than 20% of that. So as Malcolm stated earlier, the law is in place, but it's the system. The law is one thing, but it's the people that are doing it. So it's the people in place that are systematically keeping us out of the process.
And the consequences of that is the lack of economic resources in our community and the spiraling of depression within our communities. So I believe there is perhaps nothing as important as creating wealth, and there's a significant wealth gap between blacks and whites, and it's widening, not getting smaller, and yet we contribute consistently to the economy. And it, you know, one of the things that always bothered me when I talk to people, and they say, well, you know, they don't want you to have their money. And the reality of it is, it's not their money.
It's our money. That's right. It's our money.
It's a whole different perspective when you start understanding that when you get a paycheck, they're taking money out of your paycheck. And that money is going to Washington, and Washington sends the money back into the community, no different than the motor fuel tax when you go to the gas pump. So in reality, you are not asking for them to give you anything. Right. And we have to understand and change how we see what they do and how we perceive it. And when we perceive it as our money also, then we take on a different perspective, I think.
You know what? The example you should for folks should be when you go outside and they start doing construction on your street or on the expressway by your house and you don't see any black faces. If you don't see any black faces, more than likely that means there's no black companies working there, right? And those projects should have participation by black-owned companies too. I mean, it happens around us so much, I think we become desensitized to it because we think that's just the way it is. But technically, when these folks are not letting us participate, they're breaking the law.
Absolutely, absolutely. Carl, you have anything you want to add to that?
Well, of course. You know, I look at it from, and I've had this debate with many of people, with my many peers, in terms of where does it start? And we have to look at where it starts in terms of our legislators. I mean, we elect people that will go and sit in these positions of what we can call power, and we elect them on the premise that they will operate on our best behalf for all aspects of our community, public safety, home ownership, adequate schools, and, of course, the opportunity to be able to accumulate wealth through business relationships, through business transactions. And the fact that our legislators, because of Charlotte and both Malcolm indicated, there are policies on the books already. We continue to talk about how do we create new policy. Well, there's policies on the books that have been put there by whoever in the past. And so the question is, when do we how do we get effective legislators, effective politicians who will act on our behalf to make sure those policies are enforced at every angle within government, for that matter, because that's where they have the most leverage because they sit right in government. And so I just look at that as being where we have been weak at in terms of having legislators who fighter who go beyond the call of duty, who challenge the status quo and put their names and careers on the line so that it can be about a better tomorrow for the collective whole other than them trying to maintain so that they can maintain their respective positions, especially when, again, these are elected positions. These people are put there by the people, and the people expect huge returns for that vote. And so, unfortunately, today and over the last decades, for that matter, I've seen failed leadership in our elective operatives who have not delivered the goods to us. And I'm really quite ashamed of of a lot of them who, you know, again, in the marijuana thing is one that comes to mind. How that was able to happen with no black participation is just beyond me. It's just beyond measures, right? Somebody, a group of people should have stopped that dead in its tracks. And so that's where I stand on this whole discrimination within policy, within procurement, within government.
If I could add something to Carl, I would say this. You know, we just had the legislature led by the Black Caucus did just have a bill passed, I believe Senate Bill 1608, which, you know, I commend them on that bill because it states a lot. I think a lot of, you know, and this is just me playing devil's advocate on what Carl's saying in terms of our black legislators, because I do think some of what they're doing, they're passing a law, right? These things, they're passing these laws. And what's not happening is the enforcement of them and the folks that are actually that are supposed to carry it out and implement. I think that the caucus is being told, hey, this is great. We're going to do this. And then they have to wait to hear back to hear what the results are. So, again, in their defense, I would say, like, again, Senate Bill 1608, the governor should sign that. That bill takes BEP goals or minority women-owned business participation goals from 20% to 30%. Black Caucus led that. The question is, are those agencies, right, that manage the procurement process for the state of Illinois, are they going to carry it out? Or are they going to come back and say, oh, well, constitutionally speaking, we can't do this, that, or what have you? And I think that if Carl has a frustration, the frustration should be aimed at Black Caucus. Don't necessarily believe that they're doing what they said they're going to do. Don't necessarily believe that just because you pass something, they're going to carry it out the proper way or they're going to follow your legislative intent. Because I think it, you know, that bill that just passed is monumental. It has a lot of stuff in there that's good for black business and for black folks. But the question is, are our allies going to carry it out? And so that we can actually see it and feel it on the street.
Well, the first thing we have to get.
And our legislators are like what we consider, they have dual roles, right? They policymakers and they should be watchdogs. They should be policymakers and they should be watchdogs. You create the law, you make sure the laws are enforced through every possible means within your political power. And look, there's no elected official that can walk into a state-run office and tell a manager of a position that's over dollars being distributed that you need to tighten this up. You got to tighten this up. That's the kind of power they wield if they choose to do so. But and we're talking about not just, and I appreciate you highlighting an example, Malcolm, but we're talking about decades of this, right? We've missed out on tens of billions of dollars over the decades, if not trillions, over the decades because policymakers have not been watchdogs on policy that they may help to even construct in some form or fashion. I mean, again, we always go back. I think everybody knows the example of Atlanta, Maynard Jackson, legislator, mayor, and all the people we had in place that enforced, was watchdogs and enforced the policies that made sure that black people built the Chocolate City and in D.C. with Marion Barry, regardless of whatever he went through, his own personal demons, that man made sure that black folks got the good. And so how do we duplicate that? Because it's examples up there, out here, that shows that works. We just need watchdogs. We just need watchdogs, man, to be guard dogs as well and to bring home the bacon to us, right? Now, forget the bacon. We require the whole pig now. Forget that. We need the whole pig.
Right.
I just want to add something, Malcolm. So yeah. I don't think the legislators, they did their job, as Malcolm said. They did they passed a monumental bill, Senate Bill 1608, that's very beneficial to the African-American community. They even created a section that calls out blacks give a goal to descendants of slavery.
Right.
But what I want to point out is when you talk about the legislators, the agencies report up to one person. and everyone knows who that person is. And I run my house, and I tell people what to do with my house. So if the agencies report up to one person, the leader of the house should tell his people what to do and enforce it. It's not the legislator's responsibility, because that's they don't report up to the legislators. But all the agencies report up to one person, and we should keep our house better.
Yeah, Charlie, you're right on point. Let me redirect.
But they have influence. We're talking about influence, right? They also have influence to be able to, right? It's no different than you want something done on your street. You go and you talk to your elected officials because you have some influence, and then they have influence to be able to pass the word. We just want legislators to use their influence to have conversations that these are the right things to do. They may not have to, right? You know, people report to select people, of course, but legislators have influence in that regards where they can say, here's what we'd like to see happen. And those things, if they respect it in their role, because they also make huge contributions through various means, those conversations, these are just conversations being had, right, over the golf course, right, over dinner, over lunch. Here's what I'd like to see happen. Can you make that happen? And that's all I'm saying.
Yeah. Well, let me go back to this, guys. You know, again, on point, you know, I got a text, and someone asked a very simple question. What does, because we talk and you know, use acronyms to explain something like BEP. So, Malcolm, quickly explain in just a moment BEP, and then I'm going to come back to a couple other questions real quick.
Okay, you're going to make me go back to my state days. Let me think of the exact wording here. But technically, BEP is the Business Enterprise Program. And so that act that was created in law was essentially the state's version of MBE, WBE. You know, and what it does is really describes that minorities, women, and people with disabilities that own businesses have the right to participate on government contracts at a certain level, right? And so they set these goals, which you'll hear a lot of times, you know, we're using 20% because that's what they set in statute here in Illinois. The city of Chicago does their own. They do maybe 25% minority, 5% women owned. But the state of Illinois kind of does the whole group together, right? It doesn't say minority goals. They say BEP goals, right? So that's minorities, women, and people with disabilities. And so that when we say BEP, we are referring to that act that, you know, that was created to ensure that we have participation.
And let me just add to that real quick. BEP is a business enterprise program, and it allows you a chance to get certified. You got to prove that you have more than 51%, that you control the business and other factors. And when you have that BEP, you are in the system that allows you a chance to have a better chance of participating. So we encourage people to get BEP certified, but it means very little if you get certified. And, you know, we're talking about now about getting more people into the BEP program. The problem is that if you get more people, but the people who are already in the program aren't participating, then I think you get a lot of people say, why get certified when the people that are in the program don't seem to be participating anyway? So we got to make sure that there's adequate participation. And we don't mean giving someone a contract who's not ready, willing, and able. We mean there's a lot of companies who are doing business with Fortune 100 companies, who are doing business with Fortune 500 company, Fortune 1000 company, but they can't seem to do any business with the state of Illinois. So they're qualified. They're just not having the opportunity to participate. And I know procurement is a little bit more complicated than how simple we're trying to make it, but we're trying to talk to our audience to understand that we have a significant challenge in front of us to make sure that we focus on the issue of creating wealth, and wealth is created by business ownership. And we have fundamentally been suppressed to a degree where there's a lot of rules and regulations, a lot of roadblocks that get in our way. So let me talk specifically about one thing. We were at the council, and there was, as Malcolm mentioned, for public record, there was a contract that was done by a firm out of Pennsylvania dealing with sexual offenders. And the council, which Charlie chairs the committee, and we had it up for debate because there was another firm who was qualified to do the work, but the white firm got the business and fundamentally went from a 2% goal down to a 1% goal. So they dropped their goal by 50%. And they had not, based upon the conversation that was had, they had not demonstrated that they even met the 2% goal that they had on the previous contract. And they had the contract for 14 years. Okay, so over close to $100 million contract, African-Americans, and I want us to focus, even though from a policy point of view, we got to talk about, you know, from a, you know, minorities meaning women, people with disability, other minorities. But when we're talking about black people and black businesses. And that contract fundamentally did not reach out. And I put a motion on the floor, as you guys recall. And I asked for the motion to be on the floor for us to terminate the contract and lead to conversation. Because when you put a second on the floor, only thing you need when you put a motion on the floor, you got to get a second. The motion died for a lack of a second. And what happened there is that it didn't get a second, which means that the motion dies. And the motion was for us to consider in the process, and correct me if I'm wrong, Charlotte or Malcolm, that it allowed us a chance to have conversation about terminating the contract and giving someone else or putting it back out for bid where we know there was adequate participation, that there were black firms that could do the work and was competent to do the work, and that we would put it back out for bid to correct discrimination, because quite frankly, it's a little bit of discrimination, or correct the contract because it was not fulfilling the objectives that I think the state had. And it died for lack of a second. And I must put it on the record that there was two people who could have seconded. Charlotte was the chair. She couldn't second the motion. There's a gentleman by the name of Jonathan McGee who works out of the governor's office. He did not give it a second, and Jesse Martinez did not give it a second. So the motion died without a second. Now, Charlotte couldn't vote for it because she was chairing the committee. Sharon Matthew had to recuse herself because it was her procurement. So when the motion to get second, what we're fundamentally saying is that we're kicking the can down the road. And why they didn't second, why Jonathan McGee didn't second it, I think it was clear. His comment was that he wanted to make sure he had all the information. And my piece is that when you ask for the second only allows us a chance to have the discussion, to move it to the council so that the council can see, hear both sides of the issue and then vote on it and make a decision. Now, correct me if I'm wrong on any of that, Malcolm or Charlotte.
Though that is a good timeline of the facts. I mean, Larry, I mean, to your point, all of this stuff that you all are going through and through these committee meetings and trying to get people to see the light, have the conversation, enforce the goals that are set on these contracts, you know, I want to make sure that we inject in this conversation the fact, and I think what was being alluded to earlier is this issue shouldn't even need you to have to go through all of those committees and stuff to fight it. This is something the governor could say, fix it right now. He could get on the phone and call his agency and say, hey, we're not doing 1% goal. Put that up to 20 like it's supposed to be or whatever. What's happening is, and I think in this situation, that vendor has become so close with that agency, the contract is now reflecting the vendor's wishes. So, for example, you just said that the vendor said 2% was too much. Now, remember, the law said you're supposed to be trying to get 20, by the way. Let's not forget we done gave up 18% already to get to the last contract. At 2%, and they couldn't make 2%. They couldn't make a 2% goal. So what they asked the agency for was say, well, can we cut that in half and make it a 1%? They might as well have said, hey, can we just get rid of the goal? Because that's essentially what they're saying. And the agency said, well, hey, we need these guys. And if they say no, then what are we going to do? The bottom line is that is somebody at an agency level making a decision that supersedes the law. How can that be? Because they don't view this particular law that benefits us as important as whatever else it is they're doing. So I think you're right. I think what happened in that committee is there are folks that you know, they work there, right? And so with them, you know, putting another agency on a hook like that, all of that affects only one person, and that person is the governor. All of these people work for the governor. And so the one thing we do know is when the boss calls and says, everybody go right, they're going to go right. If the boss never calls, they're going to go whatever direction they want to go because they haven't been told. So all of these problems can be fixed literally, with a directive coming from the governor's office. But to your point, no, you didn't miss any of it. And it's actually still surprising because they were really trying to explain the 1% as if that was like that made any sense, because really we're supposed to be talking about 20%. Yeah. So, yeah, you hit it right on the head.
And let me just say this, you know, because I did call their names out specifically, because it's all public record, and both of them could have passed, could have given it a second for discussion, and they chose not to, for whatever reason it may be. And I won't pretend to understand what their reason was or was not. They are more than happy to come on the show and state their position. And when you see them, you ought to ask them, why come you didn't give it a second for discussion? Because it didn't mean that we were voting on it. It simply only meant that it could have been for discussion and it could come back to the committee. Sharla and I see procurements all the time, $100 million procurements in IT, you name it, and they have no goals. If we don't call and challenge people on it, those contracts go out with no participation. Right. And it's a difficult job to do, but we have to protect. We're obligated. You know, from my perspective, when people put me on the board, they know who I am. They know I represent black business. And if you didn't want me to represent black business, then you shouldn't put me on there. So when you put me on there, you knew me. I wasn't hiding who
I
was.
Right.
So you want me to do what I'm supposed to do, and that is to be fair and make sure that black business is represented. So I
Larry,
think
what's those names again?
Jonathan McGee. And,
Jonathan McGee, okay.
Yeah, and Jesse Martinez was the two who would not give it a vote. So let's take about, Charlotte, how often, guys and Malcolm, do we see procurements that come out and have no goals on it? And why is that important that we find a way to make sure that doesn't happen anymore?
It happens all the time. It happens all the time. You know, I use examples because, again, I was the director of Central Management Services. There is a large – healthcare contracts are lucrative. They're big, right? And so there's an insurance contract for the state of Illinois employees that is a very large contract that lacks goals, that just went out without goals on it, which means, you know, probably another $20 million or so that could go to black-owned businesses. You know, this stuff, literally, if you, and again, so someone like me that follows the bulletin, you will see a lot of contracts that either come out with zero or very, very low goals, and they give you all of these different reasons why. But if you start to add it up and think about what the goal would have been, every year, black businesses are probably missing between $100 and $150 million of opportunity that's gone because these goals aren't being enforced. So you start to think about over 6-7 years, we missed $1 billion. That you start running the tab and looking back and going back 10 years, 15, 20 years, you start to see that the investment in our community is gone. That's what this does. It keeps billions of dollars away from us. And I'm not even exaggerating, trying to get everybody. This is really happening. And it's so systematic. It's been happening so long that now black folks are like, what can we do to get some of the money that by law should already be going to us? It's ridiculous. So that's the impact. The lack of the goals means they stole our money. And then they're telling us, prove to us why you got to get it later, because you ain't going to never get the money we already didn't give. You see what I'm saying? It becomes, you know, we are begging. We got a law. We fought and got a law passed. Now we're begging our ally to enforce it so that we can stop. So 50% of all black businesses during this pandemic are gone. So the state has the ability to inject money immediately into our community. And they're saying, nah, we're not going to do that. And then they're going to give you all of these administrative reasons why not. It's really sad. And it really, for us, you have to view it as the term you always like to use. You always like to coin justice delayed is justice denied. And that is what's happening to us. Our economic prosperity, our economic opportunity delayed is it being denied.
And it's absolutely devastating. And it's a very you know, we're business people, but we're passionate about what's right. And we have an obligation. I believe every individual who have put in a position to impact change has an obligation to make the change. Let's talk about one other quick thing.
Before you go ahead, you move ahead, Larry, I just wanted to add something to what Malcolm said. So Malcolm said, what can we do to get our money? There are things in place, and Larry has fought very – Malcolm, you started fighting with while you was in at Central Management Services.
Hey, Charlotte, we got 1 minute. Yeah, I'm getting
there. There's something in the BEP Act that states that we could use sheltered markets to ensure that it's an opportunity to, that only minorities and women can bid on particular contracts. And Larry and I have voted on at least two to be used by state agencies. And it's hard to get that enforced just as well.
And it's advertising and IT services. And advertising is big market. So, you know, our program is coming to an end. Let me thank WVON. We will be coming back every week to have a meaningful conversation. This is the very beginning of what I consider to be a great dialogue. We hope that we will share information that will enlighten you and help you to wake up to realize your full potential by participating in economy. Again, thank you for joining
us. They owe us
thank
some money, y'all. Guests. They owe us some money.
Thank all our guests for coming out. Again, thanks, WVON.
Thanks, Larry.
Have a great day.
All right.
It's time to build a new land. I know we can do it if we all lend a hand.